This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of the Armature Corporation, providing consulting, application development, and business productivity solutions on the Microsoft platform. Federal Tech Talk is the show that opens up the world of technology to the federal government. Every week, John speaks with public and private sector IT experts to help you understand some of the IT trends and challenges that your agency may be facing. Federal Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, John Gilroy.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Dr. Seth Foldy. He is the Director of Public Health Informatics and Technology Program Office for the CDC. Good morning, Doctor. How are you today?
Great, thank you.
Fresh from a plane coming up from Atlanta just to do this interview. I love it coming in here for this. We've done a lot of interviews about health-related issues in the past. We've done issues on electronic medical records. We've done a whole hour segment on vaccines.gov. I thought we'd bring in someone from a different perspective to maybe give our audience an enlightened view of informatics and the health profession and technology. But before we dive into this serious subject, tell us about your background, Doctor, and how you wound up working for the CDC, if you could please.
Well, that's kind of a two-part answer. The first question is, how do you end up doing informatics? And the other question is, how do you end up doing public health? And
it's like a doctor who's an auto mechanic. He can do two different jobs.
Exactly. So, you know, doctors are information hungry people. They're constantly trying to figure out how to manage all of the information they're trying to remember, recall, use, convey to patients. So a lot of us tend towards the use of technology to do this work. But also as a family doctor for many years, I became, like most doctors who go into public health, kind of disgusted and discouraged at how much preventable disease and preventable injury I was seeing all day long. And I decided to go into public health to do something about it. My first stop was the local health department in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which had recently undergone a massive waterborne outbreak, where the public health system learned that they didn't know when a third of the people in this county all had diarrhea at the same time. And we realized we had to have some way of tapping into the healthcare system's data to know of events like this, that the old-fashioned ways of reporting wouldn't always work. So we developed a number of interesting solutions there. Then in the mid-90s, this led to work on that I did on health information exchanges in the country. And for the last 2 years, up till last October, I was state health officer in Wisconsin, dealing with other critical public health and information systems, such as how do we know where H1N1 pandemic flu is going and coming from, and what do we need to do? Do we have the vaccine, and have we gotten the vaccine out? Questions like that. These are the questions that public health informatics answers in one way or another, and I joined CDC in October.
Oh, great. Many of my listeners may not work in the health area. Many of my listeners may work in the military area, but I think if you take it from a conceptual framework of collecting data, trying to analyze it, and then generating a report, someone's life or death is at stake in public health, same thing over in the Pentagon, life and death, data collection. I want to bring in your perspective on security and transparency and the state of the art and cloud computing and what CDC is doing. And you have a kind of a unique role at the CDC. You got like a thumb in every pie there, don't you? You're the guy who's a thumb in every pie all over Atlanta.
That's right. Very low resources, lots and lots of friends. And you know, my job is to try and span the many activities across CDC and get some cross-cutting advantage out of the information that we receive and analyze and the knowledge that we produce. It's interesting, the security and military sector and the public health sector are starting to use a lot of the same terms, such as early warning. How do we know that something is happening or about to happen? Situation awareness. Do we know where we are in this epidemic? Is it rising? Is it falling? And then, of course, intervention. You'll hear out of CDC more and more, the point of what we do is to change the curve of sickness and injury. We are the nation's prevention agency. And what that really means is engineering ways to reduce risk across the country, whether it be through people's behavior, the healthcare system, public policy, or improving the environment.
Pick up the newspaper, you hear about the people in South Dakota with the flood waters coming in. Of course, the engineers are worrying about the flood, but people like you are worrying about what's going to happen to the folks there? Is there what kind of disease is going to come up, and what kind of public health challenges will we face? This is fortunately in a predicted manner, but some are unpredicted.
Exactly. So the prevention mission is always a forward-looking mission. It asks the question, what might happen next, and how can we reduce the risk of what might happen next? So as you say, as people are displaced, for example, they're starting to go into shelters. That starts to generate all kinds of questions, such as, how can rescue and first responder workers know if somebody is okay and in a shelter, or whether or not they're in trouble and hanging from a tree? We need systems that will tell us if there are outbreaks of disease going on in shelters. After food stores and restaurants have been affected by a flood, we may need to be able to know if outbreaks of foodborne illness are likely to happen and what to do to stop them. And also, do people need special vaccines in this kind of situation? Being electronically linked to share this information is part of my mission.
You hit the hot button vaccines. We had the folks from vaccines.gov on the air about 3-4 weeks ago. And they decide to supply their information, what their job is to transfer as much information as they can to as many people, and they want to be transparent. Now, you know, vaccines.gov, you want to be transparent about the information to make perfect sense. However, if you take the concept of transparency and apply it to electronic medical records or to CDC, the rules change a little bit, don't they?
They do indeed. Yeah, CDC was a big leader in this area when more than 10 years ago we stood up the CDC Wonder. It took information that came from national health surveys, census, and other data, and made it publicly consumable over the internet and even a little bit before the internet. However, when you do that, of course, you have to be extremely cautious to make sure that information, even if it's aggregated, can't be broken back down again into, let's see, if there's only one person in the census tract and they have HIV and they also have purple hair, oh my goodness, I can tell who that person is. So public health has worked for a long time on algorithms and processes to make sure that no personally identifiable information can get out, and to make sure that aggregate data can't revert back to personally identifiable. Now, I'll be the first to say that's a growing challenge as algorithms and the ability to scrape huge amounts of data off of public sites, non-government sites, increase people's ability to affect people's privacy. But that's a big obsession of ours in public health. Now, I will say, Centers for Disease Control, as a national agency, doesn't get a whole lot of information, name-identified information about individuals. Most of that information ends up being managed at local health department or state health department levels, and most of the work at CDC is turning that information into knowledge that we can use to train people to prevent better, to pass laws that prevent better, and those kinds of activities. But there's not a huge amount of personally identifiable information maintained on anybody at the federal level at CDC.
So can we pull out that sentence and label that as informatics? You talk to a layperson there. You could be talking to a cab driver and say, we try to get information that we can do actionable information. So is that what informatic is from your perspective?
Absolutely. As we mentioned before we went on air, I consider some of my earliest informatics projects to have been done with paper and pencil. Yes, I was automating my collection and access of information, maybe by using a form, but basically the whole issue is, how do you get data, how do you turn it into information, and how do you turn that information into knowledge?
What are, just give me maybe an obvious challenge in collecting information from your perspective.
So let's go back then to this situation where suddenly a lot of people are having diarrhea in a city. And first of all, how might a public health agency know what's going on? And then how might they try and figure out what to do next? If we can know some information about where the diarrhea is occurring, the age groups in which it's occurring, a little bit of information about the habits of those individuals. Are they campers or fishers? Are they all eating a certain type of food? Are they all taking a new type of drug? Then we can start making reasoned hypotheses about the cause. So in the cryptosporidium outbreak in Milwaukee in 1993, the goal was to figure out all of these patterns that ended up pointing, for example, to a water treatment center. So this becomes actionable information, because you can then turn that into, people in these parts of these communities need to boil the water from the tap before they drink it, and we can start to turn the curve of the epidemic in the other direction. That's just one example, and there's gazillions of them.
And I don't think my listeners are going to find that too strange. We had American Systems on last week, and one of their tasks was to go into a war area and collect IEDs, bring them back here, and gather information on them and try to predict what's going to happen in the future with other IEDs. And the big fancy pants word is predictive analytics, which all it means is seeing what happened in the past and maybe that's going to happen in the future, direct application for health as well.
Absolutely. While we were leading the epidemic H1N1 pandemic response in Wisconsin, my question to staff is, where is this going next? Are cases continuing to rise? Are they going to rise rapidly? How many people are going to go off work? How many healthcare workers and public health workers are going off work? That's predictive analytics.
Going to take a quick break, talk more about predictive analytics and gathering data and some challenges that the CDC faces. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Dr. Seth Foldy, Director, Public Health Informatics and Technology Program Office at the CDC.
Engineers have come up with a new way to deliver cancer-fighting medicines. They're disguising them as red blood cells. Sending drugs into the body to fight cancer is truly like a combat mission. If detected, the immune system destroys the medicines in minutes. But if they can
stay longer in the system, they will have longer time to circulate in the bloodstream to find the diseased cells or the tumor size.
Liangfang Zheng, a University of California San Diego engineer, says a good camouflage helps. So he's wrapping tiny drugs, called nanoparticles, with a red blood cell membrane cloak, either from matching blood bank types or better.
You can actually collect the blood from the patient himself. And then you use these blood cells to make the nanoparticles.
Such disguised drugs lasted in mice for almost 2 days. More at www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
What if I told you that you could learn a new language the same way you learned your first language? With no tedious translation, no useless memorization, and no boring drills. You would have every right to be skeptical, especially if you struggled with languages in the past. That's why we want to send you a free demo CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone. You'll find out what U.S. diplomats, more than 10,000 schools, and NASA already know, that this is the world's fastest, easiest way to learn a new language, guaranteed. Call now to request your free CD-ROM and try it with our compliments. Learn a language faster than you ever imagined. Call 1-800-600-6612, and we'll rush you the free Rosetta Stone CD-ROM today. Remember, there's no tedious translation, memorization, or drills, and the Rosetta Stone program offers more than 30 different languages. Call for your free Rosetta Stone demo CD-ROM today and see how easy and effective it really is. Call 1-800-600-6612. That's 1-800-600-6612.
My name is Abe Lincoln, and I've been thinking about this cool place that you can go. It's a website that I speak of called USA.gov. It's government information online, and that's mighty fine. USA.gov. Got questions on your log cabin? Housing answers, yeah, they have them. USA.gov is your official source. Get Social Security info, whatever that is. ID theft prevention tips, because that's your biz. Even change my address, and I don't mean the Gettysburg. Find government auctions, jobs, apply for student aid. Hey, I wouldn't lie, I'm Honest Abe. It's government made easy for the people. Take it from the dude in the stovepipe hat. USA.gov is where it's at. So don't wait 70 years to check it out. And that, my fellow Americans, is what I'm talking about.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
ACT IAC is looking for a few good members. Do you have what it takes? Are you a techie or a govy? Do you want to make a positive impact? Can you bring fresh ideas to the table? Join ACT IAC today and help solve government's toughest IT challenges while advancing your career and making great new friends and contacts. To become a member, visit actgov.org. That's actgov.org. Or call 703-208-4800. ACT IAC wants you.
Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Dr. Seth Foldy, who's the Director of Public Health Informatics and Technology Program Office at the CDC. Before the break, we talked about challenges. And if you'd like to find out more about the CDC, you can fire up your little Google box, your Google machine, and go to cdc.gov, and then just search for informatics and find out more about what they're doing in this area. It has so many different applications. In the break, I was asking Dr. Foldy about, in my world, they talk about this concept of governance, risk, and compliance. They just spit it out, GRC. And same is true with the CDC's interest in governance. Is that right?
It is, and it's a little bit more complicated sometimes than in other fields. So national defense is a national enterprise. Public health is actually an enterprise that's reserved to the states as a part of the state's police power in the Constitution. So, in fact, much of the work that happens in public health is created at the local and state level with organizations like the Centers for Disease Control working very hard to make sure we're all working together, employing evidence-based practices, and developing a national level of situation awareness of what's going on out there
governance.
And what to do next. And so you can imagine that it is not a situation where the federal government simply orders local and state government what to do. The fact is, we need information systems that are sensitive to the needs of the public health nurse in a small town, but that ultimately information can roll up to the national level and even the global level. So when a new version of the flu virus comes out that's hurting people in a new way, we'll be ready to know and to respond. So governance can get pretty subtle. It's not just how do you govern the goals and the progress of an information system, but how do you govern the relationships, the data sharing relationships and data use relationships?
There's a local company called Silo Smashers. Mm-hmm. And when I look at you, what's his job? Well, he's kind of like a silo smasher. He's got his thumbs in all these pies, and the governance there is difficult because you have to understand exactly what the limitations and the strengths are of the federal responsibility, but there's state responsibility here as well, and you have to be able flexible enough to respond to some emergencies. And it's a difficult juggling act. But guess what? People are trying to move to the federal cloud, exact same issues with where is it going to be stored? Stored in Chicago? Is it going to be stored outside the country? Well, there's governance issues there, and there's governance issues in the medical world, and they're almost parallel.
I used to talk a lot about silo smashing, and then I began to realize that grain is held up by those walls,
yeah,
and you don't always want 7-grain cereal every morning.
Yeah.
And so when I'm more and more respecting the concept that different systems are set up to do certain things in certain ways for good reason. And what we really need are bridging systems that can pull and take information as needed. And of course, the emerging science of web services and similar applications make that more plausible tomorrow than it was yesterday.
One of the challenges is responding to that nurse in rural Ohio and how she wants information. And I guess because I'm an old geezer, an old man, I think they'd try to get information on a computer somewhere. Well, John, I got to get up to speed here. That may not be how they want that information, is it?
No, the computer is in her pocket or on her belt, of course.
That's the truth.
And now that, you know, sometimes the biggest challenge is how to camouflage that item in a tough neighborhood. But nevertheless, the information has to go mobile if it's going to be cheap and effective, better, faster, cheaper. So you imagine the old paradigm of a nurse about, you know, who belongs to a program. Maybe it's the lead poisoning program.
Yeah.
But she's about to enter a home where the same child and other children may be under vaccinated, or a young adult in the household may have HIV infection, or we may be looking to treat a communicable disease. Why should that individual not have that information at his or her fingertips before they knock on the door? This is what I'm talking about, pulling information from the silos, repackaging it, and provisioning it to the user to help them do the work at hand. And sometimes it means bringing all the information you have around a given individual together. Now, that's something that most people would like to see happen at the local level. On the other hand, they don't necessarily want the federal government to know everything about everyone.
You're in a tough spot. I mean, you're
so
we have to
respect. So we respect that by trying to support an architecture of information that enables the one-on-one client relationship at the local and state level that often exists, and the national imperative to know what's going on at the federal level without violating people's privacy.
There is a movement called Accreditation for Public Health Facilities, Public Health Accreditation Board, brand new. And what fascinates me about this is that they're managing to do this little dance between the states, I don't want to say states' rights, but actually it's states' rights and the federal mandate from the Obama administration to help these people and find out what's going on and use federal resources. And one of their solutions is this public-private partnership where they're working with Robert Woods Johnson. And I sat back and said, well, this is a good model for some of my listeners. I mean, there are many agencies out there, not necessarily a health agency, but they're challenged with certain things, and maybe they can learn from this model and say, well, the folks down in Atlanta, look, they got assistance with a private organization to help them with this project, and the project's very successful.
And it did grow from the grassroots as well as from Atlanta. And things that just grow straight out of the federal government's forehead don't always work. But the need for every public health agency in the country to have a certain base level of infrastructure. So when we're talking about infrastructure, a lot of people think about roads and bridges, but information systems, workforce competency, and good administrative systems, those are the roads and bridges of public health, right? So the concept that if every jurisdiction doesn't have some minimum level, then our public health fabric as a nation is very weak. That idea came from the local level as well as from the national level. And that's where a good public-private partnership like this really takes root. And we're very pleased, of course, that the Public Health Accreditation Board is going to be looking at, among other things, what are the base requirements for information management that any public health agency, even in a small community, should have before they can call themselves a fully qualified public health agency.
You know, it's interesting that when you collect data, it involves electronic technology. When you store the data, it's electronic technology. And what about accrediting organizations to be able to collect that data that involves information technology? So they got to have a physician who also is part nerd, so he can say, look, you know, it's not going to work. Here's what's going to work. And so your challenge is to understand the public and private relationship as well as understanding how it's reacting to changes in technology. All of a sudden, that nurse in North Dakota or South Dakota that's looking at a flood wants to be able to use an iPad to securely get information. Okay, doctor, what are you going to do now?
Yeah. The future direction of our work in informatics is based on breaking public health down into business processes. What are we automating? We're not automating nursing. We're not automating disease control, but we might be automating, how do I find the address of this patient? We might be automating, has the laboratory information confirmed that this person has a communicable disease? We might be automating, how do I know whether motorcycle injuries, head injuries are going up or down in my community? Those are business processes. And so unless one really gets back to the roots and asks, what is the problem that the worker is trying to solve? You're not going to create information systems that are truly better, faster, cheaper.
Do you try to encourage websites to be mobile friendly and get redesigned, or is your focus more on adapting the technology so it can be input securely from a mobile device, or juggle both of those? Or there's a certain amount of time in the day. I mean, how do you split up that two disparate types of requirements?
Exactly. Well, and CDC's different units split these functions up to some extent. We have a fabulous communications center that is primarily involved in the work of pushing information out through both social and non-social media. However, in my shop, we have a very small but very agile research and development lab. And the communications group is a big customer of our research and development lab as they look for new and better ways to push information onto mobile in a user-friendly way.
No, I know you're from Ohio. In Ohio, we say agile, but in Atlanta, they say agile, huh? You've become Southern.
I've lived too many places now, I guess.
It's real agile. We come back, we'll talk about being agile and responding to situations in a very flexible manner, yet still retaining some of the security considerations we talked about earlier in the show. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today in the studio, Dr. Seth Foldy, Director of Public Health Informatics and Technology Program Office at the CDC.
Are you on Facebook? Do you Twitter? So does Federal News Radio. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio or join the Federal News Radio Facebook group. For the latest in federal news and government contracting, visit our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Being big, thinking small. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. It's not uncommon for overweight or obese people to think of themselves as thinner than they are, even think their weight is normal. But a study indicates those who misperceive their weight may also guess wrong on their cholesterol levels and their waist size. At the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, Mabubur Rahman saw that in national survey data on 6,000 overweight and obese women ages 16 to 49.
Misperceivers are more likely to have abnormal level of total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, triglyceride, and waist circumference.
Those blood, waist, and weight problems can raise the risk of heart disease. The study, supported by the National Institutes of Health, was presented at a meeting of the American Society of Hypertension. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Here's Sean Kingsbury, CIO Recovery Accountability and Transparency Board, on the virtualization, what federal managers need to know panel sponsored by Microsoft and Citrix.
Virtualization really is an enabler to the five characteristics of cloud services. So in essence, our goal was to meet our timelines. Again, I mean, we had extreme timelines. So to do so, instead, we stood it up our environment, the test dev environment up in the cloud first, which in essence, we virtualized the infrastructure.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Virtualization is just the starting point to building a dynamic data center. With decades of experience in business critical applications, Microsoft and Citrix can provide your agency with the most comprehensive, cost-effective VDI experience by integrating management of your physical and virtual desktops. No wonder their customers are doing more by spending less. Learn how to leverage VDI to transform your telework experience and move to the cloud at microsoft.com/govcloud. That's microsoft.com/govcloud.
There are those who dedicate themselves to a sense of honor, to a life of courage, and a commitment to something greater than themselves. They have always defended this nation and each other. They still do. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Vacation time is just around the corner. Ready to go? Since 1967, Ackerman Security has been keeping families like yours safe and secure. For just $18.95 a month, you can trust in the protection of Ackerman's nationally certified monitoring center. Ackerman offers the latest technology like cell phone control, wireless monitoring, and remote video to your web-enabled phone, iPad, or laptop. Federal government employees get an added bonus. 4 months of monitoring free. Call 888-999-1070 or AckermanSecurity.com.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
An FBI healthcare fraud investigation lands Miami medical staff in prison.
It was just a big fraud.
I'm Molly Halpern of the FBI, and you're listening to Gotcha. MetroMed of Halea Corporation purportedly provided HIV-positive Medicare patients injection and infusion therapies. But as case agent Francis Schapansky explains, the treatments weren't given.
The doctor falsified the medical records and the medical assistant falsified the medical records.
The patients were HIV-positive but had normal platelet counts.
They would thin the blood to make it appear that they had a low platelet count.
The patients were in on the scheme.
They saw this as an opportunity to make money. For each treatment, they would receive between $100 and $150.
The clinic submitted $23 million in claims and received nearly $12 million. The fraudsters were sentenced between 4 and 19 and a half years behind bars. This has been the Bureau's Closed Case of the Week on Federal News Radio.
Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Dr. Seth Foldy, who is the Director of Public Health Informatics and Technology Program Office from the CDC. Talked about a wide range of topics. I think one topic that all my listeners have maybe front of mind is this whole budgeting issue. I mean, everyone's budget's getting pulled back. They're expected to be transparent. They're expected to move to the cloud. I tell people that many of my listeners get to work in the morning and beat their head against the wall and go home at 5 o'clock at night because they're being asked to do a whole lot with less. This concept of a public-private partnership, I really like it. I like that. And maybe some of my listeners can learn from that and just find out more about how CDC did it and maybe apply it to their situation.
Well, let's look at one huge effort to try and improve efficiency and reduce unnecessary costs across healthcare and public health. And that's the HITECH Act, the Health Information Technology for Economic and Clinical Health. It was part of the stimulus package, but it was very warmly supported on both sides of the aisle. And this is the attempt to get electronic health records in doctors' offices and hospitals that not only will do work internally, but also be able to exchange information with various parties, including public health. So that is, in a sense, a massive public-private partnership stimulated by federal incentives, but basically involving investment by hospitals and doctors to do what they already wanted to do, but they weren't quite sure how to get over the hump. And once that investment is made, we can ask the question, how can we use national standards to reduce the cost of getting information from a hospital, say, to a public health agency? Right now, hospitals are affected by many different laws, most of them state and local, that say you must report communicable diseases, injuries, you must report cancer, you must report this, you must report that. Well, that's a cost. It's important. The outcomes are amazingly important, but can we automate it? So as doctors and hospitals start moving to electronic health records, how are local and state governments going to move their systems to receive reports using more national standards?
And guess what? The local health officials, their budget's being pulled way back too.
Right.
It's not like they're having staff added. They're having staff pulled away. There's got to be a way to automate some of this or maybe use technology. Okay, if you're sitting in Louisiana and your staff gets pulled back to 45 people, well, maybe you're going to have the gun to your head to automate. Okay, we're going to have to move to electronic medical records.
Exactly.
There's no choice.
And this whole movement creates actually even more budget challenges in the short term because there are all these legacy systems that have to be brought up to a new standard to get there. And that's where my office comes in. Basically, since October when I've been there, I've made our number one priority answering the question, how do we get healthcare and public health communicating electronically? Because before long, people aren't going to be able to afford or be patient enough to do it on paper. But also, how do we help state and local agencies get to where they need to be to start working in this electronic environment? It's a big challenge, but a very exciting challenge. Some of the real concrete results that are likely to happen just in the first year or two of this HITECH Act meaningful use process is that doctors and hospitals will, very large numbers of them, be sending immunization records to immunization registries so that the next doctor can know if a child is fully immunized or not, as well as sending laboratory information for much less money than it takes to do it on paper to a public health department. So a public health department at the local level can say, oh my goodness, this person has hepatitis A. We'd better find out whether or not they're a salad handler before they infect hundreds or thousands of other people. So we can really start leveraging this investment in electronic health records for public health good, as well as making the healthcare system better.
So would that be the definition of a health exchange, health information exchange?
Health information exchange is the process whereby information moves from one organizational entity to another. That's right. And there are, some people talk about health information exchange as a verb, and others talk about it as a noun, and in many cases they are both. I established a health information exchange before coming to CDC in Wisconsin. And we were able to use that to know real time how many people were walking into emergency departments with flu-like illness, and also how many of those people were becoming hospitalized. And we were able to use that kind of near real time, or really virtually real time data, to make a decision like, wow, should we close the school system in Milwaukee, Wisconsin? There's a whole lot of people running into our emergency rooms with flu-like symptoms. This must be really big. And then we look and we say, ah, but almost none of them are going into the hospital. This is, maybe we should sit and wait and watch for another 24 or 48 hours and watch, let the data accumulate. So this kind of near real-time relationship with clinical information can help public health make a big difference in their community. We kept an awful lot of workers on the job by not shutting down the school systems in the state of Wisconsin. And those are the kinds of examples of how sometimes high consequence decisions have to be made on good comprehensive access to real-time data.
When you talk about clinical trials and clinical tests and information, it gets so serious, it's sometimes difficult to communicate a serious topic to the general population. And if you go to the CDC website, you find out a press release by the Surgeon General comes up with this very creative way to convey a complex idea. He came up with this zombie apocalypse, and he said, what happens if there's a zombie apocalypse? And he has a little checklist, and it was all tongue-in-cheek. But what happened was he got a lot of hits and a lot of information, and he managed to communicate. His information was, well, actually, if there is a flood in your area, here's the things you should do. And I thought it was very creative, wasn't it?
Absolutely. So two object lessons there. I don't really want to talk about this because I didn't invent it, and I'm terribly jealous. But
it's
yes,
pretty clever.
We want public health to go viral in the right ways. It actually points out, incidentally, that a lot of what goes viral about health these days doesn't originate with federal or state health authorities. And in a way, we're competing now for the eyes and ears of the public, where amateurs can scrape data together before official public health can release it in a responsible way. So that's a big challenge for public health. How does public health get the responsible message to the public first? Our appropriate use of social media is, of course, one way that we can do that. The other thing that it posits, this whole, those who haven't seen Zombie Apocalypse should know that basically it argues that the response to a zombie apocalypse is an awful lot like a response to a pandemic or a hurricane. And what that means, there are certain generalizable things that you should be able to prepare for and do in almost any kind of hazard, what we call an all hazards approach. Well, I do take somewhat of the same approach to informatics. We will be well served if we can build a few informatics systems that are robust and do a lot of the things we do every day, rather than build a different siloed system for every conceivable type of public health problem or public health emergency. Or, as we talked about before, you know, be able to connect our public health systems so that we can use them to agilely respond to, again, a hurricane or a zombie attack.
If you look at this town, you see a whole lot of electronic medical records over at the Pentagon. And another big grouping of electronic medical records are over at NIH. And then we have, I mean, if you just look at the United States, there's the veteran population, and there's the public health population. I mean, I guess this is what the electronic medical record is all about. It's one ring to, not to rule them all, maybe one ring to be able to use information correctly. These are big, huge gobs of information, electronic medical records, is an attempt to come up with a standard way of exchanging some information here.
Absolutely. The benefits will be immense. Obviously, people's concerns about their privacy and security have to be very confidently and competently handled. But again, so when I, you know, when we were able to see whether people were being admitted or not to hospital with flu or going into emergency departments with flu, we didn't need to know their names. We didn't need identifying information at all. And as a consequence, we didn't have that information. So information sharing, terribly important. So is the concept of not sharing what you don't really need to do the job, and taking every precaution to preserve privacy and confidentiality. Those will be challenging problems. Obviously, the threats to information security are constantly rising. But I don't think there's any going back to the paper record without basically breaking our health system worse than it already was.
And because whether people realize it or not, paper is just too expensive.
As I'm trying to remember who it was who used to wear the button on his lapel, paper kills. When it comes to healthcare, The fact that somebody is allergic to ampicillin is lost somewhere in that paper chart. Instead of hitting the doctor in the face on the video screen, that kills.
And get back, we're going to talk a little bit more about informatics and managing wide varieties of different types of databases with sensitive information. You are listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we have Dr. Seth Foldy, Director of Public Health Informatics and Technology Program Office at the CDC.
For over 40 years, ManTech employees have been solving complex problems for the national security community. Whether they're providing secure satellite communications to the Department of Defense or investigating threats in cyberspace for intelligence agencies, their work is distinguished by high ethical standards and a deep commitment to their customers' success. They've created a culture that encourages individuals to bring innovative ideas and technology to those charged with protecting the homeland. Due to the high demand for ManTech skills and expertise, they have tremendous career opportunities for cleared, highly skilled IT professionals, security experts, intelligence analysts, engineers, and technicians. In 2010, ManTech was selected for Fortune Magazine's 100 Fastest Growing Companies list, named a top 10 best employer for veterans by Military Times Edge Magazine, and for the fourth year in a row, was selected as a top 10 military-friendly employer by GI Jobs Magazine. Apply for openings today at mantech.com/careers. That's mantech.com/careers. ManTech is an equal opportunity employer.
Profile America, Tuesday, July 12th. It's the height of the summer vacation season, and across the country, Americans are taking part in their favorite outdoor activities. From hiking and rock climbing to swimming and boating, or just enjoying the scenery. From Alaska to Florida, millions of us will have fun in the many national and local parks and recreation areas in every state in the Union. To highlight this marvelous resource, this is National Parks and Recreation Month. There are almost 80 million acres of national parks and recreation areas and 14 million acres of state facilities. These facilities draw a combined total of just over 1 billion visitors annually. That's about 3 visits each year for every person in the U.S. You can find these and more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov.
Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit, presented by NITP, has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on Federal News Radio at 10 a.m. Join me this week for my special guest, Jennifer Duplessis, a member of the Kearney team at George Mason Mortgage. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia. If you'd like to know more about the firm, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
Here's Dr. Doug Fritzma, the director of the Office of Interoperability and Standards, the Office of National Coordinator for Health Information Technology, on the Federal Executive Forum on Healthcare IT, sponsored by McAfee.
I see a future in the government in which we enable the private and public sectors to identify common solutions and create shared solutions, endorsing a set of standards, services, policies that will allow interoperability to occur, and then enforcing compliance so that we can be assured that the security and the trust is maintained.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Tresemme Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
The rapid rise in cybersecurity threats and compliance requirements make protecting citizens' confidential information increasingly challenging. McAfee is the standard throughout federal, military, intelligence, and civilian enterprises worldwide. McAfee's capabilities are essential to assuring federal networks remain resilient against the latest cyber threats. To learn more about how McAfee can help your organization combat cybersecurity threats, call 888-VIRUS-NO or go to McAfee.com/government.
Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, Dr. Seth Foldy, Director, Public Health Informatics and Technology Program Office at the CDC. This is a time, Doctor, to get up close and personal. This is my scientific 10-question survey to to determine if, in fact, you are a nerd or maybe a nerd wannabe. First question is, what was your first computer?
I think it was 1982, the Apple IIc.
That's a little late, but that's okay. Your first cell phone?
Frankly, can't remember.
Oh, that's not a good sign. The nerds are shaking their head at this one.
It wasn't a brick, but you had to fold it to use it.
Operating system on your computer at home?
Windows.
That's pretty standard. And your connection at home, any kind of fancy pants connection like a T1 or?
Just cable.
Okay, well, you're not getting a whole lot of nerd points here. Type of mobile phone you use?
Smartphone.
Oh, that's good. And the flavor smartphone?
The iOS.
Okay, that's good. Number of apps on your phone?
About 30.
That's moving up there. Do you have a tablet device?
Not now, but I did 6 years ago.
Whoa, now the nerdometer, the meter's starting to...
Well, but we were testing devices for inspecting restaurants.
Social networking sites you participate in?
Facebook and LinkedIn.
And the last book you read, piece of paper or electronic?
Both. I never actually finish books. But on airplanes, I read on the iPhone.
I never thought of that. I guess it would be electronic then. I guess it's a mixed batch or best of breed. I never thought of that. You read on the iPhone on the plane.
It's really very practical.
Well, that's great. Let's go back to a more serious discussion here about the CDC. And, I always look at the CDC and say, well, geez, you know, it's an organization that's involved in many different activities, a lot of research there, a lot of public health. Where do you think it's going to head in the next 4 to 5 years? Bigger, smaller? Tell me more about the CDC and where you think it's going to head.
Oh, well, I think the nation desperately needs greater, not lesser, investment in prevention. But I can't predict the way of the nation over the next 5 years. Assuming that our budgets might get smaller, we need to be able to, and oh, I shudder when I say this, do more with less. And that probably means be a lot smarter about how we're managing information. And at CDC, some of our efforts are, as I was mentioning in the last segment, using electronic health, the new world of electronic health records and health information exchange to do the work of prevention more efficiently. And then secondly, working to help local and state government, as well as CDC, use information more efficiently to do their job better, faster, and cheaper. We do want to stay abreast of the latest developments in technology, and we do this partly through our research and development lab, to make sure we identify opportunities to do things either better, faster, cheaper, or all three. At CDC, a lot of very important work that is done in that realm is laboratory testing. We're the kind of the court of last appeal about what is this germ, what is it resistant to, what is it going to do to people? And upgrading the systems for the management of laboratory information is also a pretty important task.
I have listeners with .mil in their email address, and I'm sure they stay awake at night worrying about attacks. And the attacks from Anonymous and LulzSec were in the newspaper here just lately. Is that a concern for you, or is that pretty much low on the list?
So for those who don't know LulzSec, you're talking about tech attacks or hacker attacks.
Yeah.
I spend all night worrying about germ attacks, so I just wanted to be clear. I do, in fact, worry about both. And I can tell you for a fact, the CDC is attacked thousands of times daily.
And I'm just trying to wrap my little brain around a hacker's motivation for attacking the CDC. This is like being in war and bombing an ambulance or something. I mean, why would they go after the CDC? What value is there?
Well, CDC is part of the nation's biodefense structure. If somebody is going to attack the United States with weapons of mass destruction based on germs or viruses or based on chemicals, based on radiologicals, the public health system is part of the national defense system against those kinds of attacks. Also, as a repository of biological information and with the value of bioinformatics and bioindustry growing by leaps and bounds. We are, after all, looking at tomorrow as being the biological era of technology. The knowledge known by a sophisticated entity like CDC can interest foreign governments, businesses, and others.
Do you have a concern with more and more nurses in rural areas using handheld devices and security of those devices?
We are actually examining this from a policy perspective now. To try and make sure that any data collection that occurs for public health purposes using mobile devices is securely encrypted and insured against both the loss of data and the theft of data.
Certainly not an easy job.
No, it's not. I work, as we mentioned earlier, the Public Health Informatics Technology Program Office. We focus a lot of our attention on how information gets used and trying to make it easier, cheaper, and more efficient to get your hands on the information right when you need it. There are other excellent people at CDC, like our CIO and our security and privacy apparatus, that work very long hours to make sure that the public, any public information, whether it be information about an individual, which, like I said before, is rare, or information about deadly germs, remains secure.
So the Affordable Health Care Act came out in 2009, kind of got blended with something else and became a law in 2010. And part of the mission of your organization is to respond to what Congress says you should do. And they're giving you specific tasks in this area, aren't they?
Absolutely. The nation as a whole, no matter what your party, recognizes the need to have a more efficient, more effective system of caring for the sick and preventing disease so that we defer or avoid medical costs. And CDC's mission is focused a lot on understanding what are best practices to prevent disease or disabling injury, and then make sure that that work is integrated into the routine work of health care. We see a huge opportunity there, as did Congress.
I'm sure there are statistics on lives that are saved through seatbelts. And if you want to reduce expenditures for health, then public health could be argued that it's not a bad ROI, is it? Return on investment for public health could be argued to be very strong and powerful.
Oh, this is absolutely the case. You look at the savings across decades and decades related to vaccine, better safety engineering, better food handling practices. Let me just give you an example. At the turn of the last century, diarrhea killed one out of every five children before age five in the city of Milwaukee. What changed? Well, what changed were that public health scientists made the connection between sewage and drinking water and diarrheal death, and they created things like drinking water disinfection systems and sewage treatment plants. After, obviously, this was an enterprise that was spun off to the civil engineers after a while. Then there was the development of clean practices related to milk, pasteurization, and others. Again, massive drops in diarrheal death, such that the death of a child from diarrhea today is a rare event. The death of a child from measles today is almost unheard of. One accomplishment after another.
It's obvious when you get in your car and you put your seatbelt on, you're reminded of that. But you drive down the street and you see 10 kids, they look pretty healthy, they're running around playing lacrosse or something. It's hard to connect the dots.
And public health uses lots of data and an analysis, what we call epidemiology, just charting the curves. Are people getting more sick more fast or less sick less fast? And we use that to draw the dots together.
Yeah, a difficult subject. In the last minute of the show, get out your crystal ball and tell me where CDC is going to head the next 4 to 5 years, where you see yourself and your program.
Well, like many parts of the federal government, we are being charged with the responsibility of reducing the costs and the complexity and even the environmental impact of massive data storage. So I think it is very likely we will be following the federal trend into more and more cloud storage. The capability of sharing information between disparate information systems will be critical. So this involves, to some extent, establishing and promulgating more and better standards so that information can be used more interoperably, as well as using newer technologies like natural language processing so that we don't always have to standardize everything, but can understand information as it comes to us in raw forms. Mobile computing, putting public health right into the pocket of the public or that public health nurse or sanitarian, is going to be another big trend for the future.
The pocket or the purse, one of those two. You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Seth Foldy, Director, Public Health Informatics and Technology Program Office at the CDC. Thank you.
You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of the Armature Corporation, providing consulting, application development, and business productivity solutions on the Microsoft platform. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal Tech Talk, Tuesday mornings at 11, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.